Keir Starmer has given himself 3 months to try and find a rule that Jeremy Corbyn might have broken. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson has decided that when it comes to his allies, rules don't apply at all. With Priti Patel keeping her job after it being officially found she broke the ministerial code, and Jeremy Corbyn losing the whip for reasons unknown, is due process dead in Britain? That's the big question for tonight. We're talking about the farce that is British party politics, and it's, you know, goes right to the top of both major parties. Dahlia Gabriel, delighted to be joined by you this evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you doing?
Very well. Delighted. You look crisp, high definition, sounds great.
People were yelling at me in the comments last week, so I thought I'd up my game.
Yeah, I hope you didn't lose any sleep. I'm going to be speaking to Rivka Brown, Navarra Media investigative journalist, on a really good exclusive investigation that Navarra Media have done on deportations before Brexit. But let's get straight on to our main stories. The intra-Labour farce overseen by Keir Starmer, in which the former leader has been readmitted to the Labour Party but not readmitted to the parliamentary Labour Party, is continuing apace. So last night it was revealed that Corbyn would be suspended from the whip for at least 3 months. So The Guardian reported that the chief whip, Nick Brown, wrote to Corbyn on Thursday night saying the whip had been withdrawn for 3 months, suspending him from the parliamentary Labour Party, pending an investigation into whether he had broken the PLP code of conduct. Corbyn has been told the decision will be kept under review and his conduct during the suspension will be taken into account. Now, the reason I wanted to get that up is that phrase. He's being suspended for 3 months pending an investigation into his conduct. Why that's odd to me is we know the conduct in question. It was 2 public Facebook posts. I've read them both. I imagine many of you have read them both. So why do we need a 3-month investigation? All the facts of the matter are currently known. So it does seem like the only thing they can be spending this 3 months doing, we know the facts of the matter, is to find a way where they can try and imply that those events broke some rules. Normally you would expect rules to be clear enough that you know if you have broken them. If you have to spend 3 months trying to find out what rule you've broken, that's not due process. In a criminal court, you don't have a jury deciding, you don't have the judge saying, we already know everything that's happened, you just have to decide, you have to look through all of these legal texts and decide if a law has been broken. No, an investigation is to find out what happened. You should know in advance what rule is under question. That's why it's all so strange. It does seem like this is an attempt to try and, after the fact, find a rule that justifies not letting him back in. We are going to talk about, you know, the reactions to this latest move. First of all, let's go through some more of the details which have emerged as to the events which led to Corbyn's readmittance and subsequent suspension of the whip. So as we speculated on Wednesday, first of all, there is sign the decision to lift the suspension was not the result of left-wingers manoeuvring on the NEC, as Starmer's allies have been implying over the last few days, but was potentially likely, in fact, I think, the result of negotiations which were taking place between Starmer's people and Corbyn's people. This is from Paul Waugh's Huffington Post email, which he sent out late last night. He writes, "One of the central charges against Starmer is that for all his protestations that he was staying out of disciplinary processes against Corbyn, his own office was actively engaged in contacts with the former leader's helpers in a bid to find a grand compromise to resolve the situation." He goes on, "That compromise involved a clarification from Corbyn that concerns about anti-Semitism were neither exaggerated nor overstated, both words he had used to talk about the scale of the issue. The clarification would be published before an NEC panel met. In return, the party would restore his membership while sending him a reminder of values, one of the weakest possible sanctions." He goes on, "It's worth saying that Starmer's allies reject the claim that there was any such deal, while accepting that Corbyn's team lobbied hard for his reinstatement. There is also dispute over alleged agreement about the timing of this clarification statement, the wording of which is said to have been agreed by both sides within 2 days of the original suspension." So you can see there, Corbyn's team, it seems, sort of briefing, look, this was agreed. I don't know what he's talking about, saying this was because of a factional NEC. He's as involved as we are. Starmer's people saying, no, there was no agreement. That obviously they were trying to lobby us, but they were doing that, you know, publicly as well. There was nothing, there were no backroom deals which happened. You know my thoughts on this. I find the idea that this was because of a factional NEC fairly implausible, given that the timing of the disciplinary panel was chosen by HQ, by Labour Party HQ. It was the responsibility of David Evans, as was the composition of that panel, and as were the lawyers who they employed to advise that panel, right? So there is nothing here which can be separated from Keir Starmer in the way that this decision was made. His man in HQ is more responsible for Jeremy Corbyn being readmitted into the party than anyone else. And the idea that Starmer didn't know, we know that Starmer was consulted when Corbyn was first suspended. I find it a little bit incredulous to maintain that he wasn't consulted here. Anyway, obviously, Paul Wall, there was a decent report, but people like Laura Koonsberg, they haven't been questioning whether or not Starmer was implicated in this, and neither have the Labour front bench, who are still very, very noisy, saying this was very political. They're just not keen to state who politicised it. Anyway, this is Annalise Dodds on Radio 4's Today programme yesterday.
Margaret Hodger, we were talking to earlier, has called the process that led to him coming back into the party within such a short period of time broken and politically corrupted.
Well, unfortunately, it's not just been Margaret Hodge making that assessment. It has also been the EHRC, which, of course, did investigate Labour's processes around disciplinary matters related to anti-Semitism. And it's a matter of huge regret and shame to my party that it found we were wanting. We have to sort out that system. It cannot remain as a politicised system. Keir Starmer has committed to altering it. And to be completely honest, we have to. We are now under a statutory duty to sort out that system to make sure that it is not politicised in the future.
But what does it say about your party then, that rather than wait for that new system to come in, Jeremy Corbyn was put into the existing process and it's all done and dusted within 19 days?
Well, as I said before, you know, it indicates that that process is not the right one. It's not the one that we need.
But it was
the
used
HRC
by your party. It was used
change,
in such a high-profile case.
And that's been put into place. We have 6 weeks to respond to that report. A large element of the response is going to be around setting up a new process, which is completely independent, which everyone can have confidence in, including the Jewish community. It's very important that happens.
A few things to note there. So obviously, she would have been under a lot more pressure if the host there had said, wait a minute, you're saying that this is clearly a politicised process. Doesn't that mean you're blaming the person in charge of that process, who is David Evans, who is Keir Starmer's pick? So you're coming on here as the Shadow Chancellor, basically to defend the leader's position. But isn't there a huge part of the leader's role in this which you are ignoring? No one asks that, because generally what people ask is, why didn't you purge Jeremy Corbyn sooner? The question of has due process happened here, not really of interest to many people in our mainstream media. She also wasn't pushed on this idea. Her answer suggested that the fact that Jeremy Corbyn was readmitted showed that this is a politicised, broken system. I'm not a lawyer, but it doesn't seem to me like a very good way of judging what is and what isn't a good process is to say whether or not you like the outcome. If she's saying, well, if it's readmitted Corbyn, it must be an unfair process, then what hope do we have of a fair process coming about in the future? Is it the case that it will only be considered objective and fair if it expels Corbyn, and otherwise it won't be? If it expels him, it's fair. If it doesn't, it's not. That's not due process. In other developments, the Labour leadership turning on the NEC, members who sat on Corbyn's disciplinary panel painting them as factional warriors with no interest in fairness. That's the impression which has been given and by everyone saying this is a completely politicised process, it's a disgrace, it's an outrage. That's understandably caused upset among those who are elected to the body. These are all volunteers. These are people who generally do this job because they care about the Labour Party and the Labour movement. They're asked to sit on a panel. They spent sort of hours deliberating over it, and now they're being attacked in the press. Anyway, 15 of them, because of this, have penned a letter to the General Secretary, that's David Evans, making their disappointment known. And we can go to a couple of the key parts of that letter. So they start by saying, on Tuesday, the 17th of November, a disputes panel of the NEC sat to consider current discipline cases, one of which was the complaint against Jeremy Corbyn MP. The panel, after many hours of consideration and deliberation, including advice and guidance on process from the head of disputes in GLU, which is the governance and legal unit, and an independent barrister provided by the party, established that there had been no breach of Labour Party rules. As such, the panel determined that Jeremy Corbyn's suspension should be lifted. The point they're making here is, look, we did exactly what was asked of us. we went along to a panel. We took advice from party staff. We took advice from the party barrister, and we followed that advice. And now when we've done what was asked of us, unpaid, after hours of deliberation, you're now going around saying, oh, these are just factionally motivated political operators. There was no due process here at all. They said, well, why did you ask us to do that then? All very justified that they're pissed off about it. Anyway, this is probably the key part of that letter they sent to the General Secretary. They write, the decision of the leader the following day to withhold the whip from Jeremy Corbyn MP is an act of deliberate political interference in the handling of a complaint. It defies the decision of the NEC panel, is a matter of double jeopardy that flies in the face of natural justice. It undermines the rule book, and it is precisely the type of action found to be unlawful indirect discrimination by the EHRC report. Again, that all seems very reasonable to me. And I haven't actually seen these points put to front benches either. People only question Labour front benches on one side, which is why haven't you got rid of Corbyn quick enough? Never. Are you sure that due process has happened here? What rule is he supposed to have broken? I haven't heard a single journalist ask a Labour front bencher, what rule has he actually broken? And they just take it as a given that he's a wrong and that should be out. Anyway, another development, it's also understood Corbyn's lawyers are challenging the process. Obviously, it seems like there were sort of attempts to come to some sort of understanding. Keir Starmer seems to have broken his side of the bargain. If there was a bargain, I can't confirm this. I'm just saying it looks like that's a plausible scenario as to what led us to the position we are now in. They are, anyway, his lawyers are now taking legal action, including subject access requests, which would be really interesting. A subject access request, you're allowed to ask an organization to show you all of the documentation they have, which includes you. So this could include internal staff emails in the governance and legal unit when they're talking about Jeremy Corbyn, talking about what rule he is or isn't supposed to have broken. Now, unless they were, you know, very diligent or using their Gmail accounts, I imagine you're going to see something that looks like political interference there. Anyway, we'll have to wait and see. Dahlia, I want to go to you on this. Could this get any more farcical?
It is, of course, an absolute car crash. The fact that Jeremy Corbyn went through the process and it was found that he didn't break any rules and yet he still doesn't have the whip is clearly political interference. But I think it's really important to actually, because I think a lot of people are sitting back and just thinking, you know, like not understanding really like why this is happening in such an aggressive and fast and sort of merciless way. And I think it's really important to actually, you know, it can be very easy in this kind of daily politics thing to kind of think about politics as something that happens in weeks. But actually, I think it's important to step back and look at the history of the Labour Party, the history of political parties in this country, especially since the 2008 financial crash. And I think that gives us a way of understanding why the PLP and why Starmer are seemingly picking what feels like an unprovoked battle. And this is much bigger than Corbyn. The ambition here is far more more far-reaching than Corbyn, and which is why I don't think that the fact that this is making the party poll very badly is actually important to Starmer at the moment. The ambition here is not really to kind of gain power amongst the British people because, you know, there's not going to be an election for the next 4 years. He's not really bothered with that. The ambition here is to use this time before we have an election to essentially undo what manifested over the past 5 years, not just in Britain, but in parties around the world. You know, we have the financial crisis in 2008. We see revolutions, uprisings happening across the world a few years later. Then we have a few dormant years, and then this sort of sudden resurgence of sort of radical politics through parties and what some people call sort of Pesokification, which is like kind of the collapse of social democratic centre-left parties and kind of the insurgence of more radical transformative demands through those parties. And the use of party politics for radical transformative demands is kind of unheard of over the past 20 years in this country. Like, think about student protests, Occupy. The Labour Party in this country was absolutely irrelevant and absent. It had absolutely nothing to do with that kind of radical transformative agenda that emerges in the aftermath of the crash. But Corbynism represents this attempt to express the need for transformation in the wake of crisis through party politics rather than kind of the street, rather than street politics. And a realigning of kind of the poles around which the political spectrum is organized. And we see that through the emergence of someone like Boris Johnson as well, in the Conservative Party. And that kind of realignment of political poles took many people by surprise. And so we really saw this kind of incompetent and sort of silly attempts to kind of regain power during Corbyn's leadership through the various coup attempts. But now we've seen, and we're seeing this also in the Democrat Party across the pond, the liberal centrist establishment sort of recuperating itself and trying to destroy any conception that this kind of PASOKification can happen again or can continue and materialize in any kind of serious way. And the humiliation and the spectacle of beating Corbyn in this way, the shunning of trade union funding, the disempowerment in favor of, you know, private financing, the disempowerment of members and unions in favor of the always more reactionary parliamentary party, is a reconstruction and a reconfiguration of the Labour Party in order to make what happened over the last 5 years impossible to happen in the future. And that's not just the aim of Keir Starmer. It is the ambition of the British state. And we are seeing the re-entry of the Labour Party into sort of the whipping boy of the state rather than a kind of insurgent in and against the state model that was represented by John McDonnell. And we can see that in Starmer. We can see that in the fact that he rarely critiques the actual principles of the Conservative Party, but says, you know, that the Tories are ideologically right. They're just incompetent. So it's back to the days of, you know, the end of history, the fighting not over ideology and ideas, but over who can kind of carry out the inherently conservative neoliberal function of the state better. So that's why I think that, you know, that explains, I think, why this feels like a kind of unprovoked and extreme attack. You know, I don't think any of us thought that Keir Starmer would end up suspending Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party, let alone that when the party found that he shouldn't have been suspended, that he wouldn't restore the whip. But when you put it into that broader context of the fact that the ambition of Keir Starmer is not really to create a popular political force at the moment, he's still got 4 years to do that, it is to reconsolidate and reconceptualize the Labour Party back to the kind of the sort of good old days of sort of pre-2015. And it's to kind of quash that broader political imagination of the country, especially as it can exist within the Labour Party. Whether or not that is actually wholly in Starmer's hands is another issue. It remains to be seen. It's an interesting question as to whether or not Starmer can really put a lid on the kind of transformative politics that often emerges at the tail end of a crisis. And especially as, you know, we're seeing another financial crisis that will likely emerge out of the pandemic, not to mention climate breakdown. It's very hard, I think, to put a lid on forces that led to the past 5 years, but this is certainly Starmer's attempt, in alliance with the state and in alliance with the media, the establishment media, to do that. And I think, you know, the question as to whether or not that will be successful relies very much on whether power can be built in other contexts.
Mm. I think that alliance you talk about between the party and the media there is so important. That's why no one's asking, wait a minute, has due process happened here? Wait a minute, was Starmer involved in negotiations beforehand anyway? Now he's sort of hand-wringing about political interference. And it's because they are perfectly happy to see, you know, the left embarrassed, sidelined, humiliated. I suppose one area where I might differ from you slightly, I mean, I agree in terms of the broad picture. I think that is the strategy of a huge part of the Labour Party, which is to say we barely have any interest in beating the Tories, actually. All we want to do is destroy the left. If in 10 years' time we can say the Labour Party looks a bit like it did under Tony Blair, where the left are completely marginalised, rule changes have happened so that they can be locked out by the constitution of the Labour Party, they'll see that as job done. Why, though, I think seeing this in terms of sort of like a broader, coherent, long-term strategy has become a little bit difficult, is because it seems, as a result of decisions made by Starmer's allies, Jeremy Corbyn was readmitted to the party on Tuesday. They knew that was going to happen. That wasn't like something that surprised them. They knew he was going to be readmitted on Tuesday. They could have stopped that if they wanted. It would have caused a right row, but they've got that anyway by not giving him back the whip. So I do think there has to be, and I would have agreed with you actually on the day where he was suspended. I thought this was just an attempt to completely humiliate the left, and I still think in a way it is, but also this is just completely incompetent. To readmit someone on Tuesday, then suspend the whip from them on Wednesday, basically because you were surprised at how big the reaction would be, to me does not spell this is just, you know, one move in a really coherent long-term strategy. It spells to me like opportunism. So it's Keir Starmer sort of looking for a good headline in suspending Corbyn, then sort of panicking that maybe suspending Corbyn had gone a bit too far. He wanted a way out of it, so they let him back in on Tuesday. Then panicking again when people like Margaret Hodge get very annoyed at the fact that Corbyn's being readmitted, even though they can't say what rule he's broken. And so taking the whip away from him. So it looks to me like they're sort of just bouncing from one event to the other, seeking a good headline. But the ultimate outcome is just that everyone thinks they're completely divided. They haven't even weakened the left by now because they've done it so incompetently. I think at this point in time, we'll talk about this a bit more in a moment. It seems like they have actually consolidated the energy of the left because Jeremy Corbyn is now a member. There isn't really any question. What's the point in leaving if the person... leaving the party out of protest for someone who's still in the party? It doesn't make sense to me. So we will see motions around the country for him to have the whip reinstated. I don't want to get ahead of myself, though. What I do want to do is focus on this question of how this looks to everyone on the outside. And I think this does really speak to how ridiculous this all is. You know, it is hard to see this in terms of a big strategy when everyone who comes out and speaks about this publicly just sounds so goddamn stupid. I'm not delighted to say that our first example of someone sort of coming out and sounding, to me, kind of irrelevant is Rebecca Long-Bailey on Robert Peston on Wednesday. Let's take a look.
I don't think you can ever exaggerate anti-Semitism or any form of racism within the Labour Party or elsewhere. And certainly I read Jeremy's statement yesterday that I think was submitted as part of his disciplinary process, and he deeply regretted the use of that language. And certainly, as I said, it might be Keir's intention that Jeremy needs to make some sort of a statement to clarify or apologise or whatever as part of this process of restoring the whip. And if that's the case, then I think those conversations need to take place tonight.
I voted for Rebecca Long-Bailey. I went on TV, argued that people should vote for Rebecca Long-Bailey. She seems like a nice enough person with decent politics. But what is the point? What is the point in going on television and saying, oh, well, I think if Keir Starmer wants him to say sorry, then Keir Starmer should call him and tell him to say sorry. Like, this is like a play. This is like the playground. This is like children. You know, he can come to the party or the club if he says sorry to him, but he has to tell him to say sorry and someone has to not say sorry. Like, come on, just go on the telly and take the principal position. Look, you don't even have to agree with everything Jeremy Corbyn said. I don't necessarily think that every statement he's ever made, and especially in relation to this, was always perfectly well judged. But the political argument here is, look, whether or not you liked what he said, you're excluding someone without being able to say what rule they've broken. It's completely outside of due process. Again, some people will be really angry if Corbyn apologizes for something he said. I don't care, to be honest. I really don't give a damn if Jeremy Corbyn apologizes or not. But I find the fact that we are now having this huge conversation about whether this is a mainstream party that wants to take power, we're led to believe. So it's a mainstream party that wants to take power, and to be a member of it, to sit as an MP for it, depends on whether or not you say sorry to someone. You know, it's like, come on, come on. Next we have Gordon Brown, and I'm sort of bringing this up because I don't want to single out Rebecca Long-Bailey. There are ex-prime ministers, people who oversaw and, you know, we're told they saved the world from the global financial crisis. They've come out of retirement to say that a politician should say sorry.
Well, Jeremy's got to make a full apology. No ifs, no buts, no caveats, no qualifying sentences. He's got to admit he got it wrong. There is no place for anti-Semitism, no place for any form of discrimination in our society. And if people are in any doubt about where he stands, he's got to make it absolutely clear he will have no truck with anti-Semitism at any time in the future. And until he makes that clear, Keir Starmer will, I suppose, continue to insist that he stays outside the Labour Party in Parliament, even though he's a member of the Labour Party.
It's like toddlers pretending to be adults, telling off other toddlers. He has to admit that he was completely wrong, and he has to say that there is no place for anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, if you listen to what Jeremy Corbyn said, that is what he said. He said that there's no place for anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. As I said, you can have your opinion as to whether or not you want him to say sorry. As I say, I think the idea that someone should be forced to say sorry before they can be allowed to be a Labour MP, just to me, I find it completely ridiculous. Let's see a bit more of that interview with Gordon Brown.
It's a very odd situation, isn't it, for anyone looking in? You know, is Jeremy Corbyn welcome in the Labour Party or not?
Well, you see, Jeremy said that the problem had been exaggerated. But I say if there's even one case of anti-Semitism, you've got to deal with it. It's completely unacceptable, and you've got to apologize. You've got to say sorry. You've got to reassure people.
I mean, I had to double take when I heard that, because I feel like that line is literally copied and pasted from what Jeremy Corbyn said after the AHRC report came out. The problem was exaggerated, but one anti-Semite is too many. I should have checked before the show, but I'm pretty sure that line or every, like, that's what he said. That's exactly what he said. And Gordon Brown is going on with no irony, not understanding that he's, you know, how he sounds and saying he's got to say this. He said that. Let's go to the positive note, which, as I say, I do think that this ridiculous scenario, partly because it has been conducted in such an incompetent fashion, kind of has galvanized the left. In my mind, it has put Starmer in the most awkward position he's been in since he became leader. This is also to say that one of the reasons I think Keir Starmer's dealing with this so badly is because he's never been put under any scrutiny in this job. If you can think of it as in Jeremy Corbyn's leadership was destroyed kind of because he was attacked too much, because he was under too much scrutiny. You know, it all ended up starting to stick. Keir Starmer, it could be the opposite. The guy has not been tested. It's a bit like when Theresa May went into that general election. Everyone was like, oh, she's amazing. She's the most popular prime minister. She's more popular than Thatcher. It's because no one had actually put her under any scrutiny whatsoever. Then the moment she's in a general election, she collapses. Keir Starmer, it seems, this is the most high-pressure decision he's had to make, and he's completely cocked it up. And I think he's cocked it up because his whole leadership up to now, no one's asked him any difficult questions. They're just like, oh God, isn't it good to have someone who looks like a politician back? He's like, oh, aren't you going to ask me any questions? No, of course I'm not going to ask you a difficult question. I'm just going to sit here basking in the fact that I'm political editor at the BBC. You're Sir Keir Starmer. Isn't this lovely? This is how I imagined it when I applied to be political editor at the BBC. I thought I'd be interviewing nice, handsome chaps like you who were once knighted by the Queen. That's not what political journalism should be like. That's what too much political journalism is like. Anyway, back to the good news. Local parties around the country have been passing motions calling for the whip to be restored. Loads of them, and I'm sure these will keep coming in. Also, the Labour Party as well, it seems to me, are still saying these should be ruled out of order. There was an argument, I disagreed with it, but there was an argument when this was an active disciplinary case within the disciplinary section of the Labour Party that was not business that CLP should discuss. As I say, I disagree with that, but there was an argument. Now that this is a case of the whip, there is no argument whatsoever. Jeremy Corbyn is not in any formal disciplinary processes. It's a political decision to not give him the whip back. I don't think Keir Starmer's even denied that. So CLPs absolutely should be able to debate this, and they should debate this. I think that's one of the most useful things Labour Party members can be doing at this point in time. In sort of a sign of the temperature rising, Dulwich and West Norwood CLP, that's a South London constituency, I used to be part of that, their delegates voted by 87 to 34, calling for David Evans, the General Secretary, to resign. Finally, I mean, in terms of the PLP, in terms of the left-wing members of the PLP, obviously the majority are not particularly Corbynite. Ian Lavery has been, you know, very loud in his opposition to what has happened to Jeremy Corbyn. Very good. He's also mentioned the possibility of a leadership challenge. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with mentioning this. I think, you know, the more awkward Keir Starmer feels, the better. But to me, this probably would be, well, I don't think it's going to happen for a start, but also it probably would be a mistake. I've seen lots of people on Twitter say, no, go for it. Let's go for that leadership challenge. The reason I say that's probably going to be a mistake is that, I mean, history shows us, one, that Labour members don't really like leadership challenges. You know, so when Jeremy Corbyn was re-elected, he was re-elected on a bigger mandate. People were like, look, he got a mandate a year ago. Now you're ripping the party apart. A vote for Jeremy Corbyn isn't just a vote for his politics. It's a vote for, you know, fairness within the Labour Party. Neil Kinnock also won a challenge in the late 80s against Tony Benn. So a very, very good challenger. But he won handily because people don't like people who are seen to divide the party. The reason Keir Starmer is on weak ground now is because it looks like he's the divisive one. So I think if the left were to mount a leadership challenge, they probably wouldn't win. And also it would probably re-energize Keir Starmer. Dahlia, I want to go to your thoughts on that. What do you think the left could, should do? Where do you think the sort of signs of hope are that sort of justice will be done here? What do you think would be a good strategy for the left to take to, I suppose, right this wrong?
I mean, it can only be through building power that doesn't just rely on party politics. And in ways, and when it comes to interacting with the party, I think it has to be in ways that recognize the factors sort of outlined that I outlined before. And that happens through many different ways. It doesn't mean going back to the kind of pre-2015 days of having like a hodgepodge of single issue campaigns. But I think it means that understanding really what the role and what the leverage of the members have within the party and being very realistic about that. I think it could be interesting to see perhaps more interest, less in the leadership of the party, because as we've seen, that doesn't necessarily translate to kind of power, but maybe looking more at a kind of ground up change, ground up transformation, maybe looking a little bit at what's happened across the pond with sort of Justice Democrats and sort of how that kind of more local politics and scaling up from there could potentially work in a context like in Britain. But I do think that being aware and building kind of a holistic transformative agenda that has clout outside of the mechanisms of party politics is sort of the only way that any attempts to change the party can actually happen. And if the leadership challenge is going to happen, which I definitely don't think it should happen now, I don't think that the streets are ready. I don't think that the left is ready. It definitely can't go like the last one did. It can't sort of take people by surprise and, you know, think that because you've got the leadership, then the more kind of foundational democratization of the party doesn't matter, and that a genuine, and that there needs to be the kind of groundwork laid for a genuinely responsive relationship between those working in the party and those on in social movements. That is not the strategy that was kept under Corbyn. Corbyn ran a very insular team that, you know, as it went on, became more and more sort of like closed off towards social movements and closed off towards the politics of the streets. So it would have to be pushed by a kind of politics that genuinely knows how to organize and leverage a base and leverage sources of power that do not rely on the kinds of, you know, on the kind of internal workings of political parties, because those are not built for transformative politics.
We're going to go to some super chats. Pete with 15 quid. Brilliant stuff as usual, guys. Isn't it about time the PLP did the political landscape a favour and do one? Student politics, I know, but feels good to say so. I mean, if you've watched this show for a while, you know my opinions on the majority of people in the PLP. That's why I support, well, not only mandatory reselection, but also open primaries, because I feel like we need to get some new talent, some new energy into the PLP, especially, and I think this point is important, actually. The reason one of our democracy is so weak is because we have a two-party system. To engage in mainstream politics, you have to be a representative of either the Labour or the Conservative parties. But it's really difficult to get that gig. And if you get that gig, you've got it for life. So another system with two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats in the United States, yes, it has all the downsides of the two-party system we have. But at least there, you have a sort of, you have a process of primaries, which is also written down in law. If Joe Biden decides that he doesn't like something Bernie Sanders has said, he can't just kick him out of the Democratic Party, because there are rules about this that people can read. They're in state law often. We are going to talk about the other big farce that's going on in British politics today, this week, which is Priti Patel. She's broken the ministerial code. Boris Johnson didn't want to sack her, so he's overridden it. Anyway, you'll get the details of that in a moment. First of all, we have a great story. Brexit was supposed to give Britain more control over its borders, but an immediate consequence could be that certain types of deportation become more difficult. Fine with us, of course. These are the deportations that fall within the Dublin regulations, which state that any EU member has the right to deport non-European migrants to whichever European country they first arrived in, without hearing their asylum claim. So if someone arrives here, claims asylum, but you say, ah, oh, you went through Greece first, the British government has the right to deport them to Greece without hearing their asylum claim. Now, we obviously won't be mourning the end of this regime. It is a way for states who are further away from the borders of Europe to basically just pass the buck and pass responsibility elsewhere. Also, you've often have people who are, you know, trying to get close to their family, etc. But in the immediate term, so the end of it, fine. In the immediate term, though, the fact it will soon end means that the government are going into overdrive to try and speed up this process and sort of trampling over due process in the process. There's a great article up on Navarra Media, which was original investigative reporting from Rivka Brown. You should check that out after the show. First of all, here Rivka explains what she discovered.
With the knowledge that the EU has rejected the UK's plans to extend the Dublin regulation post-Brexit and therefore would lose the ability to use the regulation on the 1st of January. There were rumours circulating in a number of asylum seeker kind of support and solidarity groups that this must be something that the UK is planning to do to maximise the regulation in the months leading up to Brexit. And so I basically just started putting in inquiries with various EU interior ministries, asking them, has the UK been making more requests for Dublin transfers to you? And lo and behold, they have. You know, Germany, which is the biggest recipient usually of Dublin transfers from the UK, has received twice as many requests this year, just in the first 10 months, as it did last year, 2,000 compared to 1,000 in the 12 months of last year. It's massive. And so I then looked into, okay, so are these requests leading to an increase in deportation flights? Because obviously not all the requests are accepted, not all of the accepted requests turn into deportations. But lo and behold, there has also been a corresponding uptick, massive uptick in deportation flights from about 6 or 7 in the past few years to 17 this year. And that's despite, you know, a 3-month hiatus because of the coronavirus lockdown. So yeah, we're rushing to get rid of people is pretty damn obvious. And the results of that are disastrous for asylum seekers, up to and including, you know, suicide in some cases.
In a way, you could ask, what's the problem with this? I mean, what they are doing is deporting people to safe countries. They seem to have every right to do. Is the fact that they are rushing into this your argument, or what you've discovered is that they are trampling over due process? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the problems that this kind of rush has created are procedural errors, but those procedural errors have enormous consequences for the lives and the livelihoods of the returnees and the asylum seekers. So, for example, it's led to breaches of the actual regulation that the UK is trying to maximise. For example, family unity, which states that if your family member is resident in the UK, then that country should be responsible for processing your asylum claim. The UK has been trying to deport people whose fathers are in the UK, for example. Another directive under the regulation is called the reception directive, which means that you need to have comparable or adequate conditions in the receiving member state. The UK has a responsibility to check out, like, does Spain have the ability to accommodate the migrants that we're sending them? Well, in one case, it didn't. We sent 11 Syrian migrants earlier this year back to Spain with absolutely no plan for their accommodation, no food. They were literally picked up by a journalist who asked them what they were doing, and they said, well, we've just been dumped here by by the UK. That's not only not acceptable, it's dangerous. We're not allowed to do that under the very EU law that we're trying to kind of make the most of.
And is it confirmed what's going to happen about the Dublin regulation? Because in a way, I would have expected sort of right-wingers to be arguing, you know, if a big danger of a no-deal Brexit is we can't deport people back to the first European country in which they arrived. Is it a priority for the Home Office to try and have something like the Dublin regulations continuing, or is it pretty much a done deal that this will be ending in January?
It's a done deal. So at least that's what I am led to believe. So the UK has been attempting to forward its own kind of equivalent of Dublin 3, which is the technical name of the regulation. And in August, I believe, those plans were rejected by EU negotiators, who basically said that it was very unbalanced. You know, we probably suggested that we should be able to send people back more easily and accept people like less easily, I would imagine, which is the imbalance they're referring to there. So from the 1st of January, we won't have use of that regulation. So there won't be a way to return people to EU member states, which is exactly why we've got this kind of administrative haste at the moment. It's possible that the UK will try and create later down the line some agreement with the EU. But for the time being, certainly, there is not going to be an interim solution to this beyond, making it easier, as the Home Office appears to want to do, to deport people back to their countries of origin. So, for example, by lowering the threshold for what allows you to deport someone to petty crime, for example, or sleeping rough, which we know Priti Patel wants to do. So, you know, in lieu of the Dublin regulation, the UK is basically trying to slacken its immigration rules to be able to deport people far more flimsy grounds back to their country of origin.
That was Rivka Brown. You can check out that article on navarramedia.com. And again, this is a good opportunity to point out that we really want to do more original investigative reporting at Navarra Media. It's the part of journalism that costs the most money, which is why most outlets are turning more to opinion. So if you want us to be able to do more investigations, to break more stories, maybe cause some problems for people in power, please do go to navarramedia.com/support and donate the equivalent of 1 hour's wage a month. An official investigation into the conduct of Home Secretary Priti Patel has found she is guilty of bullying her staff and therefore is in breach of the ministerial code. The ministerial code sets out the minimum standards required of a cabinet minister, and convention is that if you've broken it, you have to resign. Every time in the past that someone has been found to break the ministerial code, they have resigned. But as we know, this is a government of firsts, and Boris Johnson has overridden the findings of the inquiry, and Judge Patel has no case to answer. The author of the report, who was the independent investigator who was given the job of making this report, he has resigned because his recommendations have been ignored. We're going to go through all of today's political fallout about this in one moment. First of all, though, I want to get you up to speed on what this is all about. Why was Priti Patel under investigation? What are the implications of it all? So we need to go back to March for the start of this story. That's because that was when Sir Philip Rotnam, who was the most senior civil servant in the Home Office, resigned very publicly on television. He's now suing the government for constructive dismissal. This is Sir Philip Rotnam back in March.
My experience has been extreme, but I consider there is evidence that it was part of a wider pattern of behaviour. One of my duties as Permanent Secretary was to protect the health, safety and well-being of our 35,000 people. This created tension with the Home Secretary, and I have encouraged her to change her behaviours. I have received allegations that her conduct has included shouting and swearing, belittling people, making unreasonable and repeated demands, behaviour that created fear and needed some bravery to call out.
It's a video which political journalists claim is memorable because you never really have senior civil servants resigning live on TV. I think most people remember it for the guy holding the umbrella over his head throughout the interview. Anyway, after that resignation and the allegations surrounding it, an investigation was launched into Priti Patel for bullying. That was in March. Why has it taken so long for us to learn about the results? That's because the government were sitting on the report, partly under the premise that there was a pandemic to deal with, but also it's been rumoured that Dominic Cummings was using its release as a threat against Priti Patel to increase his leverage over her. That seems to be the kind of guy he is. Last night, finally, a summary of the findings were released. The full document is still not being published, even though there are demands from people in the Standards Commissions and the Labour Party to get it released. It won't be, but the summary is here. It's by Sir Alex Allen. He concludes, "My advice is that the Home Secretary has not consistently met the high standards required by the ministerial code of treating her civil servants with consideration and respect. Her approach on occasions has amounted to behaviour that can be described as bullying in terms of the impact felt by individuals. To that extent, her behaviour has been in breach of the ministerial code, even if unintentionally." This is pretty clear. Priti Patel has broken the ministerial code. That's what he has judged. He was the person, the independent investigator, who was given the job of finding out whether or not she had broken the ministerial code. He says she had. Now, there's obviously lots of pressure for her to resign. Matt Hancock, well, there was this morning, we now know the outcome, but this morning, Matt Hancock was the first person to go out to field questions about this. Surely she's going to have to resign. Here he is on BBC Breakfast. He's asked a question in the abstract whether a breach of the ministerial code should mean that a minister resigns.
Well, that is a judgment for the Prime Minister. What I'd say on this is that I've worked with Priti Patel a lot. I think she's an excellent Home Secretary. She's been nothing but courteous and kind in all the dealings that I've had with her. And I know that she's absolutely focused on delivering the commitments that we've made to improve the safety of our streets across this country, for instance, by recruiting 20,000 extra police.
Okay.
We've already recruited more than 5,000 extra over the last year. So Yeah, she's working very hard on that agenda.
I'm not expecting you to comment on the character of one of your colleagues. What I'm asking, I suppose, is you are a member of the cabinet, you are a minister, and there is a ministerial code which you abide by. Would you feel comfortable sitting next to another minister who has been proven to have broken the ministerial code, still in the job?
Well, that is a judgment for the Prime Minister, not for me. And what I would say, though, is that I feel very proud to serve in a cabinet with Priti Patel. And I think that she's doing an excellent job and is an excellent Home Secretary and really delivering on the things that matter to people, the commitments that we made and on which we were elected. And as I say, in all the dealings I've ever had with her, she's been nothing other than courteous.
She can't be a workplace bully because she's always been nice to me. You have the same seniority as her. You're another cabinet minister. The fact that she's nice to you does not mean she's nice to the people who work under her, which presumably Matt Hancock knows, but they're just taking the country for fools. Obviously, the pressure for Boris Johnson to sack Priti Patel, he found a way to avoid that. And it was in a sort of characteristically Boris Johnson-type fashion. He worked out that actually, formally, it's his ultimate responsibility whether or not to find someone has or has not broken the ministerial code. So even though there's been a months-long investigation by the person who was, works as Boris Johnson's specific advisor on ministerial standards, he can, as Prime Minister, he's the ultimate boss of Priti Patel, he can just overrule that. He can say, nope, I've read the report and I disagree. No ministerial code was broken. Priti Patel, for her part, has at least said she's sorry.
I'm sorry that my behaviour has upset people, and I've never intentionally set out to upset anyone. I work with thousands of brilliant civil servants every single day, and we work together day in, day out to deliver on the agenda of this government. And I'm absolutely sorry for anyone that I have upset.
I'm sorry for anyone that I have upset, not for anything she's done. You will note Boris Johnson's controversial move to completely override and ignore the results of the independent investigation has led to the resignation of the author of that inquiry. That was Sir Alex Allen, apparently a very distinguished person in the civil service. Dahlia, I want to go to you on this. Obviously, we've seen the Conservative strategy on this. Seems to be in part effective. We don't know what the iterative effect will be, but they say, look, convention is this person should resign. It happened with Dominic Cummings. We don't play by those rules. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, he got away with it with Dominic Cummings. I presume he'll get away with it again. I'm not surprised that a woman who takes extreme joy in throwing people into cages, in calling Black Lives Matter protesters thugs, sending dinghies of desperate refugees back out into the sea, is a bully. I wish there was more focus on the impact of her terrorization and her brutality on people whose names we will never know, rather than only when it happens to senior civil servants. You know, that is a much bigger scandal. To me, you know, the dramatic impact that has on, physical health, on mental health, the breaking down of the spirit of individuals, of communities, the dehumanization that is wrought as a result of the policies that we see her enact, which have been really effectively outlined by Rivka in the previous segment. You know, she has gotten away with huge amounts of not just cruelty, but pure corruption. Whether it's voting against making the detention of pregnant women illegal, using like anti-Semitic tropes around North London elites, this is stuff that she gets away with. And it's the fact that she it's almost somewhat reassuring to know that she lives out her politics in her everyday life in the form of taking sort of some kind of thrill in dehumanizing the people around her.
At least she's non-discriminatory in her arseholery. She's not just an asshole to people who are, you know, overly policed or people who are trying to migrate to the UK. She's also an asshole to middle-class civil servants in Westminster, although not to Matt Hancock, apparently. I do want to focus on the bullying angle, though. I mean, I obviously agree with you that the most significant downsides of Priti Patel's existence are the decisions she makes as the Secretary of State. You know, the way she treats people who are overly policed and the way she treats people who are trying to migrate here. But the workplace bullying angle, I do think, is important as well, because this isn't just something that applies to middle-class people in Whitehall. Workplace bullying is an incredibly, you know, it's a problem that, you know, most people will understand on a personal level. It can ruin lives. And sort of the dismissal of it, and in the fashion that the Conservatives have done, which is just to say, well, she's nice to me, I do think does, you know, does have lasting damage. I want to, for, you know, the sake of fairness, point out that in this report, there were some sort of mitigating factors which were cited. And that's what the government are using to say, look, yeah, she might have broken the ministerial code, but you've got to focus on the mitigating factors. Focus on those. So we will read those. This is also from the summary of the findings of that inquiry. So Alan writes, there is no evidence that she was aware of the impact of her behaviour and no feedback was given to her at the time. The high pressure and demands of the role in the Home Office, coupled with the need for more supportive leadership from the top of the department, has clearly been a contributory factor. In particular, I note the finding of different and more positive behaviour since these issues were raised with her. Tory MPs have been really focusing on that line about the need for more supportive leadership within the Home Office. So you'll have lots of MPs coming out saying, we know how difficult the civil service are. She was probably just responding to people who were fairly obstinate and not doing what she said. The report did say that people could have been more responsive to her than they were, been more flexible, were the words they used. But others have suggested that, you know, this is saying, oh, she's only broken the ministerial code and there's all these mitigating factors, so maybe we should just accept it. But former permanent secretary at the Treasury gives us a different and I think useful perspective. He's saying that the bar to have broken the ministerial code is actually pretty high. So this guy used to be the top civil servant at the Treasury, Nick McPherson. He tweets, two thoughts of the day. Bullying at work is never justified. It can cause huge misery for those affected and their families. In my experience, things have to be very bad indeed for a cabinet office inquiry to find fault in a minister. The system is rigged to conclude the contrary. I think that point's very important, because people will wonder, how can it be the case that the Prime Minister, who clearly has a political interest in saving his Home Secretary, is the final arbiter when it comes to whether or not someone has broken this? And the person who's writing the initial report is himself and fundamentally an employee of the Prime Minister, not indirectly, because they're a civil servant. They're a top civil servant in the employ of Her Majesty's government. So you might think this was always rigged from the outset, and this top civil servant is suggesting that probably is how you should look at it. So even if they say, yeah, she broke it, but there's some mitigating factors, the bit that's surprising there is that this report came to her having broken it, err on the side that it's worse than what was said in the report than that it was better than what was said in the report, basically. And here, when it comes to this issue of workplace bullying, saying if she bullied people, they probably deserved it, or maybe it was just people being overly sensitive, the person pushing back against this most heavily probably is the representative of people who work in the civil service. This is Dave Penman. I'm speaking earlier. He's General Secretary of the FDA. So that's one of the civil service unions.
What is the point of the ministerial code then? What is the point of the investigation? If actually what we're saying is, it doesn't matter what evidence is found, it doesn't matter what the Prime Minister's own advisor on the ministerial code says, if it is politically convenient for the Prime Minister to ignore it, he will ignore it. He's also Minister for the Civil Service. Let's be clear. This investigation has found that the Home Secretary bullied her staff. That's the conclusion that the Prime Minister's advisor on the ministerial code has reached, including shouting and swearing at civil servants. The Prime Minister, in his foreword to the ministerial code, said there will be no bullying and no harassment. He didn't mean it. Those words are hollow now. What message does it send, not just to civil servants in the Home Office, but across the civil service? If you want to raise a complaint against the minister about their behaviour, the outcome of that will depend on the politics that's happening at the time. That's the clear message to civil servants from the Prime Minister.
It's a very powerful point there. You're saying if you complain against your boss, if it's not politically convenient for your boss to face consequences, then the government will completely ignore it. I think probably, though, more unedifying than the fact that Priti Patel hasn't resigned is the way Tory MPs are justifying it. And we've seen all sorts of tweets which basically take this format. We're going to start by going to Andrea Leadsom. She says, I have known Priti Patel for many years as a friend and colleague. Yes, she's strong and forthright in her views, which is one of her great assets. I have never seen her bully anyone. She is also empathetic and incredibly kind. I think this would be distasteful to sort of say when the allegations were first made. As I've said already, I don't think whether or not you are a workplace bully has much to do with whether or not you're nice to people who are, you know, your equals when it comes to levels of authority. Often the worst bosses are really, you know, brown nosy to the people above them. So the fact that a boss is nice to you, very powerful person, doesn't necessarily mean they're nice to the people that work under them. But also, yes, I've never seen her bully anyone. This is basically not just saying, look, she might have behaved badly, but she's also a nice person. Maybe we should treat her sympathetically. This is outright just denying that what was in the report is in the report. They say, oh, they found that she's guilty of bullying. I haven't seen it, so I don't believe it. It's like this person had the official role to do this independent investigation, and they were tasked with doing it by your government. It's not like an external organization that have come in. It's not like The Guardian have done an investigation into Priti Patel. It is the person whose job is to do that investigation who works under Boris Johnson. The other one is IDS. Apparently, he's been sort of rallying the troops to come out with tweets like this. So he wrote, I've worked with Priti Patel for a number of years and always found her to be strong, robust, and determined to get the job done. She's a hard-working and good Home Secretary. There is a history of poor civil service leadership at the Home Office, and the report is critical of that. Yes, the report is critical of that. The report also says that Priti Patel is a bully, which is the part of the report you are ignoring. One of the problems here, I think, is the fact that there's no grey area. When you have this sort of zero tolerance policy, if you've broken the code, you have to resign. And that means the government either have to say you're sacked or you didn't break the code. And I think in this situation, Priti Patel should just be sacked, obviously. But I wouldn't really have minded if Boris Johnson had come out and said, look, she's clearly done some things wrong, but the report also said her behavior has improved over the past 6 months. And the report also sort of noted that this was a difficult situation. So while what happened was obviously wrong, absolute solidarity to anyone who was bullied, and she's going to do some training, etc. I think we should keep her in a job because of all her benefits. Obviously, I don't think she has many benefits in that job, but he does. But they have instead said, nope, she didn't bully. Nope, not bullying. She was nice to me. She's not a bully. And it's exactly the same as with Dominic Cummings. If they had said about Dominic Cummings, look, he broke the rules. That's terrible. And we condemn that in the strongest possible terms. He's getting a massive telling off. But ultimately, we still are going to keep him in the job because we believe in second chances, et cetera, et cetera. I would have thought that was a bit weak, you know, because the rule he broke was so audaciously bad. But it was audaciously bad to break it in the way that he did. But if they had said that, I would have at least had a bit of respect for it. Instead, what they said is they said, nope, he hadn't broken a rule. You know, they just lied to us. So if they had been honest and saying, look, we're not going to fire them because we want them to have a second chance, or we're taking into account the mitigating circumstances, fine. But don't stand up to the public and say, nope, a bully is not a bully. She might have been found guilty of bullying, but she's nice to me. Ah, yes, we might have evidence that he broke all of the lockdown rules, but he didn't. That was basically what they said. Dahlia, I want to go to you on this. It's this sort of habit that this government have of kind of gaslighting the public, of just saying what's the case is not the case, because that's the way they get the outcome they want.
Well, I think it's an awareness on their part that today's, you know, for them, for kind of their party and their sort of particular kind of politics, today's news is tomorrow's chip paper. So it's kind of this idea that we can just sort of ride things out. And if they got away with Dominic Cummings breaking the lockdown rules, I think they're much more like, I think people generally will be more frustrated and angry about Dominic Cummings breaking the lockdown rules and getting away with it when everyone else is being expected to make these massive sacrifices for the kind of national effort against coronavirus. I think people generally will feel the blowback for that is generally much stronger than the blowback finding out that an MP is sort of bullying the civil service. I don't think that's something that will necessarily stick, because people will feel like, well, that doesn't really impact my life. So, you know, so I think really it is a kind of very sober understanding that Boris Johnson has of what he can and can't get away with based on precedent. We have to remember that, you know, this is, you know, Boris Johnson, it feels like he's not been in power for that long, but actually in the time that he's had. He's routinely done this kind of testing of what he can get away with, this testing of, you know, whether it's going after judges or whether it's, you know, suspending parliament, and, you know, as he sort of did at the beginning of his leadership, and this constant testing of the waters and being able to get away with it, which then only emboldens him to do so further. And the fact that he has unity amongst in the party, and, you know, a very soft ball approach in terms of critique from the media, means that it kind of makes sense as a strategy for him, because in many ways, Preeti Patel is kind of one of the ministers that is sort of most committed to his particular agenda of excessively nationalistic, reactionary Brexit outcome.
The aspect of this story that no one in the public is going to care about is that someone broke the ministerial code and then didn't resign. No one knows what I had to look up what the ministerial code was today so I could explain it to you. And I'm someone who's very politically engaged. So, you know, the reason why Dominic Cummings breaking the rules stuck is because he broke rules that everyone else was religiously following. No one's going to care that this person broke the ministerial code. The problem for me, though, and again, I don't think this is going to do serious political damage, because I think many people will think, well, maybe the civil service are asking for it. But the problem for me is that the way the government have responded to these is by basically normalizing workplace bullying, by coming out and having all of these people in high positions of authority saying, nope, workplace bullying, kind of fine sometimes. Maybe the workers were being difficult. As long as they're nice to other people of their boss class, then that's fine. And again, with Dominic Cummings, it's supposed to say, look, you can all break the lockdown if you want. Which is one of the reasons why we had, it's so difficult to get cases down right now. So again, yeah, I agree. And it, something that was impressive in a way about the sort of Cummings-Johnson operation is that they sort of called the bluff of sort of hand-wringing liberal media class who were saying, you can't possibly prorogue parliament. You can't possibly break the ministerial code and not resign. You can't possibly. And they're like, look, no one gives a shit. And it turned out no one gives a shit. But there are some serious negative consequences in terms of the lessons it's sending out. Not only to, I'm not saying this in a sort of patronizing way, you need to give people advice. It's a message they're sending out to Britain's establishment and to Britain's powerful about what they can get away with. If you're a workplace bully right now, you're probably feeling a little bit reassured. Boris Johnson said that swearing and shouting at your staff is okay if they're a little bit difficult. Maybe I'm just robust. Maybe Ian Duncan Smith would just call me robust. I think the precedent it sets, really dodgy. David Cameroon tweets on the hashtag TiskySour, is this no apology Priti's third or fourth chance after breaking government rules? I think she's broken the ministerial code twice before, I think. Is it just once? The one I remember, the one I know, because it was sort of very entertaining day on social media, was she had done some sort of freelance negotiations work with the Israeli Prime Minister when she was International Development Secretary. So she had to resign because of that, but she found out, or we all knew before she did, because she was on an aeroplane when it happened. Dahlia Gabriel, it's been an absolute pleasure being joined by you this Friday as ever. Have a wonderful weekend. Have a wonderful weekend, all of our audience. If you want to support Navarra Media, if you want to support TiskySour, please do go to navarramedia.com/support. We'll be back on Monday at 7 p.m. For now, you've been watching TiskySour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.